infinite complacence, people went to and fro over the earth about their little affairs, serene in the assurance of their dominion over this small, spinning fragment of solar driftwood, which by chance or design, man has inherited out of the dark mystery of time and space.
Why don't you ask me what it feels like to be a freak?
The power of a new generation.
Greetings, you're listening to Savage Science Radio here at Jackalope 105 FM, and I am your host, Tracy Savage. Let's get a little music started to put you in the mood for tonight's show. You know, when humans come in contact with the subject that they are uncomfortable with, they tend to make it tangible by turning it into a bit of a metaphor so that they can deal with it. Death is one such subject, and since the ancient Greek times, with Thanatos, for example, representing, people have tried to personify death. It's not surprising. Death is a fundamental part of the human condition. It represents the end of the life cycle and, depending on one's religious beliefs or not, the beginning of an eternal punishment or reward, perhaps. Now, death is a force that is difficult for most people to deal with. It is especially difficult to explain to children whose first experiences with death usually are marked by the passing of a family pet or, say, a beloved grandparent. Now, maybe the concept is easier to comprehend if it carries a recognizable visage. Now, the personification of death has been prevalent in the science fiction and fantasy genres, of course, with the humanistic versions of the Grim Reaper appearing frequently in literature, film, and television. The Grimm's brother's fairy tale Godfather Death, for example, depicts death in the role of Godfather. In that short tale, a man becomes a world-famous physician with the help of Death, who takes a special interest in the young man because he is his godfather. He assists the young man in determining who can be saved and who must die. When the young physician saves the life of the king against Death's wishes, Death forgives him, but warns him not to go against him again. But when the king's beautiful daughter falls ill, the man once again crosses Death, who lives up to his namesake and punishes the young man. Can't get away from that, right? But the moral of the story is clear. Death is a powerful force that will not be cheated regardless of a person's identity. More recently, Piers Anthony depicts death in his Incarnations of Immortality book series. The first book, On a Pale Horse, which was, I think, 1986, follows the disappointing life of a loser named Zane. When confronted with death, Zane reacts defensively, killing Death in the process. Anthony includes an intriguing concept: if a person kills Death, he must become Death. The book is not without its share of humor. Of course, it's pretty good. Death's pale horse can double as a sports car. Again, we have our imagery going on in our metaphors. Now, on the small screen, the classic television series The Twilight Zone, which ran from 1959 to 1964, made several attempts to put a human face on Death. The most memorable occurred in arguably the most famous episode of the series, The Hitchhiker, which was done in 1960. Benignly played by Leonard Strong, Death continuously appears on the road ahead of a young lady named Nan Adams. She was played by Inger Stevens. And as she travels across the country, by the end of the episode, she realizes she is indeed dead and accepts her fate. I believe there was another a movie that was called Carnival Souls, which is basically a cult classic, and she doesn't get it for a while either. Eventually she does. And in The Twilight Zone would later return to Robert Redford to play Death in Nothing in the Dark, which was in 1962. With his famous good looks, Death helps lead a stubborn old woman into accepting her fate. This episode fails where The Hitchhiker succeeded, in many people's opinion. Death is given a bit too much dialogue in the story, seeming more like a human character than a powerful presence. Now, Thanatos didn't actually appear all that much in actual form in the old Greek stories as well. So that sort of had departed from the tradition. And also, leading an elderly woman into the afterlife simply doesn't match up to the shock of learning that a beautiful young woman in her 20s had just died. So, you know, there's a bit of a difference, a disconnect there. Now, going to that particular story, The Hitchhiker, it wasn't originally from The Twilight Zone, actually. It was from a suspense episode from Old Time Radio known as, well, of course, it was called The Hitchhiker, and it was well-known because the radio play was transformed into that TV episode, and it has since lived on in reruns. In that story, or this story, a supernatural hitchhiker follows the main character on a trip across the country. Orson Welles, for whom the role was written, first performed The Hitchhiker on CBS Network's Mercury Theater on the Air in 1941, and then again on Suspense in 1942. Probably a little bit clearer copy there. Now, the radio play was written by Lucille Fletcher, who also wrote Suspense's most famous episode, Sorry, Wrong Number, which we will have on this show. This episode also features her husband, the legendary film composer Bernard Herrmann, who composed and conducted the music. Now, in 1960, The Hitchhiker became an episode of, like we just said, The Twilight Zone. But this radio version has some chilling sound effects. Well, chilling or hokey, depending on, you know, your point of view. Listen for the sound effects of the phone call made by Wells, and the suspense builds as his call goes from operator to operator across the country. It also shows how many people just had to be involved to make a simple phone call way back then. I think we're dating ourselves here. This episode was originally broadcast on September 2nd, 1942, and of course, the hitchhiker is a new personification of death, and I hope you enjoy.
The Columbia Network takes pleasure in bringing you Suspense. Suspense, Columbia's parade of outstanding thrillers, produced and directed by William Speer and scored by Bernard Herrmann. The notable melodramas from stage and screen, fiction and radio, presented each week to bring you to the edge of your chair, to keep you in suspense.
Good evening. This is Orson Welles. I'm very happy I am to be back in the United States and back on the Columbia Network. Even for so short a visit as this one. Back with old friends like Johnny Dietz, who's tonight's director, and Bernard Herrmann. The Mercury Theater presented tonight's radio play for the first time last year. They came right out then and hailed it as a classic of the medium. Nobody argued the point. A lot of people asked us to do it again, so it's gratifying to get the chance now. And to find a favorite of ours in this distinguished anthology of spook shows. Personally, I've never met anybody who didn't like a good ghost story. But I know a lot of people who think there are a lot of people who don't like a good ghost story. For the benefit of these, at least, I go on record at the outset of this evening's entertainment with a sober assurance that although blood may be curdled on this program, none will be spilt. There's no shooting, knifing, throttling, axing, or poisoning here. No clanking chains, no cobwebs, no bony and or hairy hands appearing from secret panels, or better yet, bedroom curtains. If it's any part of that dear old phosphorescent foolishness that people who don't like ghost stories don't like, then again, I promise you, we haven't got it. Not tonight. What we do have is a thriller. It's half as good as we think it is. You can call it a shocker. It's already been called a real Orson Welles story. Now, frankly, I don't know what this means. I've been on the air directing and acting in my own shows for quite a while now, and I don't suppose I've done more than half a dozen thrillers in all that time. Honestly, I don't think even that many, but it seems I do have a reputation for the uncanny. Quite possibly, a little escapade of mine involving a couple of planets, which shall be nameless, is responsible. Doesn't really matter. Don't think I disapprove of thrillers. I don't. A story doesn't have to appeal to the heart. It can also appeal to the spine. Sometimes you want your heart to be warmed, and sometimes you want your spine to tingle. The tingling, it's to be hoped, will be quite audible as you listen tonight to The Hitchhiker. That's the name of our story, The Hitchhiker. Camp on Route 66, just west of Gallup, New Mexico. If I tell it, perhaps it'll help me. Keep me from going crazy. I've got to tell this quickly. I'm not crazy now. I feel perfectly well, except that I'm running a slight temperature. My name is Ronald Adams. I'm 36 years of age. Unmarried, tall, dark, with a black mustache. I drive a 1940 Buick, license number 6Y175189. I was born in Brooklyn. All this I know. I know that I'm at this moment perfectly sane. That it's not me who's gone mad. It's something else. Something utterly beyond my control. I've got to speak quickly. At any minute, the link may break. This may be the last thing I ever tell on Earth. The last night I ever see the stars. 6 days ago, I left Brooklyn to drive to California.
Goodbye, son. Good luck to you, my boy.
Goodbye, Mother. Hey, give me a kiss, and I'll go.
I'll come out with you to the car.
Oh, no, it's raining. Stay here at the door. Hey, what's this? Tears? I thought you'd promise me you wouldn't cry.
Oh, I know, dear. I'm sorry. But I do hate to see
Mother,
you.
I'll be back. It'll only be on the course 3 months.
Oh, it isn't that. It's just the trip. Ronald, I wish you weren't driving.
Oh, Mother, there you go again. People do it every day.
I know, but you'll be careful, won't you? Promise me you'll be extra careful. Don't fall asleep or drive fast or pick up any strangers on the road.
Oh, gosh. I think I was still 17 here, you two.
Oh. And why? I mean, as soon as you get to Hollywood, won't you, son?
Of course I will. Don't you worry. There's nothing going to happen. It's just 8 days of perfectly simple driving on smooth, decent, civilized roads. With a hot dog or a hamburger stand every 10 miles. I was in fine spirits. The drive ahead of me, even the loneliness, seemed like a lark. I reckoned without him. Crossing Brooklyn Bridge that morning in the rain, I saw a man leaning against the cables. He seemed to be waiting for a lift. There were spots of fresh rain on his shoulders. He was carrying a cheap overnight bag in one hand. He was thin, nondescript, with a cap pulled down over his eyes. I would have forgotten him completely, except that just an hour later, while crossing the Pulaski Skyway over the Jersey Flats, I saw him again. At least, he looked like the same person. He was standing now with one thumb pointing west. I couldn't figure out how he got there, but I thought probably one of those fast trucks had picked him up, beaten me to the Skyway, and let him off. I didn't stop for him. Then late that night, I saw him again. It's on the New Pennsylvania Turnpike between Harrisburg and Pittsburgh. It's 265 miles long with a very high speed limit. I was just slowing down for one of the tunnels when I saw him, standing under an arc light by the side of the road. I'd seen quite distinctly the bag, the cap, even the spots of fresh rain scattered over his shoulders. He hallooed at me this time.
Hello! Hello!
I stepped on the gas like a shot. That's lonely country for the Alleghenies, and I had no intention of stopping. Besides, the coincidences, or whatever it was, maybe the Willies. Stopped at the next gas station. Fill her up.
Certainly, sir. Check your oil, sir?
No, thanks.
Nice night, isn't it?
Yes. It hasn't been raining here recently, has it?
Not a drop of rain all week.
Oh? Oh, I suppose that doesn't done your business any harm.
Oh, people drive through here all kinds of weather. Mostly business, you know. There aren't many pleasure cars out on the turnpike this season of the year.
I suppose not. What about hitchhikers?
Hitchhikers here?
What's the matter? Don't you ever see any?
Not much. If we did, it'd be a sight for sore eyes.
Why?
Oh, a guy'd be a fool who started out to hitch rides on this road. Look at it.
Then you've never seen anybody?
Nope. Maybe they get the lift before the turnpike starts. I mean, you know, just before the toll house. But then it'd be a mighty long ride. Most cars wouldn't want to pick up a guy for that long a ride. And you know, this is pretty lonesome country here. Mountains and woods. You ain't seen anybody like that, have you?
No. Oh, no, not at all. I was just, a technical question.
I see. Well, that'll be just $1.49 with the tax.
Gradually passed through my mind a sheer coincidence. I had a good night's sleep in Pittsburgh. I didn't think about the man all next day until just outside of Zanesville, Ohio, I saw him again. It was a bright, sunshiny afternoon. The peaceful Ohio fields, brown with the autumn stubble, lay dreaming in the golden light. I was driving slowly, drinking it in, when the road suddenly ended in a detour. In front of the barrier, he was standing. Let me explain about his appearance before I go on. I repeat, there was nothing sinister about him. He was as drab as a mud fence, nor was his attitude menacing. He merely stood there, waiting, almost drooping a little, the cheap overnight bag in his hand. He looked as though he'd been waiting there for hours. And he looked up. He hailed me. He started to walk forward.
Hello! Hello! Hello?
No, not just now, sorry.
Go to California?
No, not today. The other way, going to New York, sorry. After I got the car back on the road again, I felt like a fool. Yet the thought of picking him up, of having him sit beside me, was somehow unbearable. Same time, I felt more than ever unspeakably alone. Hour after hour went by. Fields, the towns ticked off one by one. The light changed. I knew now that I was going to see him again. And though I dreaded the sight, I caught myself searching the side of the road, waiting for him to appear.
Yeah, what is it? What do you want?
We sell sandwiches and pop here, don't you?
Yeah, we do in the daytime. But we're closed up now for the
night. I know, but I was wondering if you could possibly have a cup of coffee, black coffee, just...
No, not this time of night, mister. My wife's a cook. She's a man.
And don't shut the door, please. Listen, just a minute ago... Just a minute ago, there was a man standing here right beside the stand, a suspicious-looking man. I don't mean to disturb you. And you see, I was driving along when I just happened to look, and there he was.
How was he doing?
Well, nothing.
You've been taking a nip, that's what you've been doing. Now, on your way before I call our sheriff Oates.
I got into the car again and drove on slowly. I was beginning to hate the car. I could have found a place to stop, to rest a little. I was in the Ozark Mountains of Missouri now. A few resort places there were closed, only an occasional log cabin, seemingly deserted. That's all that broke the monotony of the wild, wooded landscape. I had seen him at that roadside stand. I knew I'd see him again. Maybe at the next turn of the road. I knew that when I saw him next, I would run him down. I didn't see him until late next afternoon. I stopped the car at a sleepy little junction just across the border into Oklahoma to let a train pass by. When he appeared across the tracks, leaning against a telephone pole. Perfectly airless, dry day. The red clay of Oklahoma was baking under the southwestern sun. Yet there were spots of fresh rain on his shoulders. I couldn't stand that. Without thinking, blindly, I started the car across the tracks. He didn't even look up at me. He was staring at the ground. I stepped on the gas hard, bringing the wheel sharply toward him. I could hear the train in the distance now, but I didn't care. And something went wrong with the car. The train was coming closer. I could hear its bell ringing and the cry of its whistle. Still, he stood there. And now I knew that he was beckoning me to my death. Frustrated him that time. The starter worked at last. I managed to back up. When the train passed, he was gone. I was all alone in the hot, dry afternoon. After that, I knew I had to do something. I didn't know who this man was or what he wanted of me. I only knew that from now on, I mustn't let myself alone on the road for 1 minute. Hello there. Like a ride?
Well, what do you think? How far are you going?
Where do you want to go?
Amarillo, Texas.
I'll drive you there.
Gee. You mind if I take off my shoes? My dogs are killing me.
Go right ahead.
Gee, what a break this is.
You hitchhike much?
Sure. Only it's tough sometimes in these great open spaces to get the break.
I think it would be, though. I'll bet you get a good pickup in a fast car. If you did, you could get places faster than, say, another person in another car, couldn't you?
I don't get you.
Well, take me, for instance. Suppose I'm driving across the country, say, at a nice steady clip, about 45 miles an hour. Couldn't a girl like you just standing beside the road waiting for Liz beat me to town? Or any town, provided she got picked up every time in a car doing from 65 to 70 miles an hour?
I don't know. What difference does it make?
Oh, no difference. It's just a crazy idea I have sitting here in the car.
Imagine spending your time in a swell car thinking of things like that.
What would you do instead?
What would I do? If I was a good-looking fella like yourself, why, I just enjoy myself every minute of the time. I'd sit back and relax. And if I saw a good-looking girl along the side of the road, hey, look out!
Did you see
him? See who?
A man standing beside the barbed wire fence.
I didn't see anybody. There wasn't nothing but a bunch of cows and the wire fence.
No?
What'd you think he was doing? Trying to run into the barbed wire.
There's a man there, I tell you. A thin gray man with an overnight bag in his hand. And I was trying to run him down.
Run him down? You mean kill him?
Say you didn't see him back there? You sure?
I didn't see a soul. As far as
watch for him the next time and keep watching. Keep your eyes peeled on the road. He'll turn up again. Maybe any minute. There! Look there!
How does this door work? I've gotten out of here.
See him that time?
No, I didn't see him that time. And personally, mister, I don't expect never to see him. All I want to do is go on living. I don't see how I will very long driving with you.
Oh, I'm sorry. I don't know what came over me, but please don't go.
So if you'll excuse me.
You can't go. Listen, how would you like to go to California? I'll drive you to California.
Seeing pink elephants all the way? No, thanks. Thanks just the same.
Listen, please, just 1 minute, please.
You know what I think you need, big boy? Not a girlfriend. Just a good dose of sleep.
Please.
There. I got it now.
No, you can't go. Please.
Get your hands off me. Do you hear me? Your hands off me.
She ran from me. As though I were a monster. A few minutes later, I saw a passing truck pick her up. I knew then that I was utterly alone. It was in the heart of the great Texas prairies. There wasn't a car on the road after the truck went by. I tried to figure out what to do, how to get hold of myself. I could find a place to rest, or even if I could sleep right here in the car for a few hours along the side of the road, getting my winter overcoat out of the back seat to use as a blanket when I saw him coming toward me, emerging from the herd of moving steer.
Hello!
Maybe I should have spoken to him then. Fought it out then and there. But now he began to be everywhere. Whenever I stopped, even for a moment, for gas, for oil, for a drink of pop, a cup of coffee, sandwich, he was there. I saw him standing outside the auto camp in Amarillo that night when I dared to slow down. He was sitting near the drinking fountain, a little camping spot just inside the border of New Mexico. He was waiting for me outside the Navajo reservation where I stopped to check my tires. I saw him in Albuquerque when I bought 20 gallons of gas. I was afraid to stop him. I began to drive faster and faster. I was in lunar landscape now. The great arid mesa country of New Mexico. I drove through it with the indifference of a fly crawling over the face of the moon. Now he didn't even wait for me to stop. Unless I drove at 85 miles an hour over those endless roads, he waited for me at every other mile. I'd see his figure, shadowless, flitting before me, still in the same attitude, over the cold, lifeless ground, flitting over dried-up rivers, over broken stones cast up by old glacial upheavals, flitting in that pure and cloudless air. I was beside myself when I finally reached Gallup, New Mexico this morning. There's an auto camp here. Cold, almost deserted this time of year. I went inside and asked if there was a telephone. I had the feeling that if only I could speak to someone familiar, someone I loved, I could pull myself together.
Your call, please.
Long distance.
Long distance, certainly. This is long distance.
I'd like to put in a call to my home in Brooklyn, New York. I'm Ronald Adams. The number is Beechwood 200828.
Certainly. I will try to get it for you. Albuquerque. New York for Gallup.
New York.
Gallup, New Mexico, calling Beechwood 200828.
I read somewhere that love could banish demons. It's the middle of the morning. I knew Mother'd be home. I pictured her tall and white-haired in her crisp house dress, going about her tasks. Be enough, I thought, just to hear the even calmness of her voice.
Will you please deposit $3.85 for the first 3 minutes? When you have deposited $1.50, will you wait until I have collected the money? All right, deposit another $1.50. Will you please deposit the remaining 85 cents? Ready with Brooklyn. Go ahead, please.
Hello? Hello?
Mrs. Adams' residence.
Hello, hello, Mother.
This is Mrs. Adams' residence. Who is it you wish to speak to, please?
What? Oh, who's this?
This is Mrs. Winnie.
Mrs. Winnie? I don't know any Mrs. Winnie. Is this Beechwood 208828?
Yes.
Where's my mother? Where's Mrs. Adams?
Mrs. Adams is not at home. She's still in the hospital.
The hospital?
Yes. Who is this calling, please? Is it a member of the family?
What's she in the hospital for?
She's been prostrated for 5 days. Nervous breakdown. But who is...
Nervous breakdown? Well, my grandmother never was nervous.
It's all taken place since the death of her oldest son, Ronald.
The death of her oldest son, Ronald? Hey, what's this? What number is this?
This is Beechwood 20828. It's all been very sudden. He was killed just 6 days ago in an automobile accident on the Brooklyn Bridge.
Your 3 minutes are up, sir. Your 3 minutes are up, sir. Your 3 minutes are up, sir.
And so... So I'm sitting here in this deserted auto camp in Gallup, New Mexico. I'm trying to think. Trying to get hold of myself. Otherwise, I am going to go crazy. Outside, it's night. The vast, soulless night of New Mexico. A million stars are in the sky. Ahead of me stretch 1,000 miles of empty mesa. Mountains. Prairies. Desert. Somewhere among them, he's waiting for me. Somewhere I shall know who he is and who I am.
Ends The Hitchhiker, and to Orson Welles our considerable thanks for his playing of the title role. Mr. Welles?
Help wanted. Men, women, and children. Nature of work, hard, monotonous, back-breaking labor. Hours, 75 a week minimum. Pay, few cents an hour. Added inducement, 2 meals a day, including several ounces of bad bread and a cup of thin soup. Don't delay. Apply at once. How'd you respond to a want ad like that, Mr. and Mrs. American working man and woman? You'd laugh, wouldn't you, and throw the paper in the trash basket. Dismiss the whole advertisement as some kind of a joke, but believe me, it's no joke. It's a simple statement of the working conditions that exist today in Nazi Germany and the conquered countries under Nazi rule. It's also an exact statement of the working conditions that'll be imposed on you and every member of your family if the Nazis win this war. You yourself personally can stop them from winning, as you know. You don't have to give up your well-paid job to do it. You needn't have to be a soldier or a sailor or an airman or a nurse or a war worker to ensure American victory. Uncle Sam doesn't ask plain, ordinary, hard-working citizens like you to give him anything. All he asks, all this he does ask very seriously and very urgently, is that you loan him 10 cents out of every dollar you make. That's all there is to it. Lend Uncle Sam a dime to win this war. And he'll pay you back with interest when he's won it. The easiest, most convenient way to lend him these dimes is to enroll in the payroll savings plan. Just tell your boss to deduct 10 cents from every dollar he pays you and lend it to Uncle Sam in your name. Sign up for this simple savings plan today, and when victory comes, you'll have war bonds in your pockets instead of Axis bonds on your wrists.
Suspense will be heard again 2 weeks from tonight. Next Wednesday night, September 9th, the Columbia Broadcasting System will present over many of these stations at 9:30 p.m. Eastern Wartime an address by W. Averill Harriman, the United States Lend-Lease Administrator in London. Mr. Harriman, as the personal representative of the President of the United States, attended the Moscow conferences between Winston Churchill and Joseph Stalin. Next Wednesday's broadcast will be Mr. Harriman's first public address since his return to this country. Suspense is produced and directed by William Spear. John Dietz was our guest director this evening. Tonight's radio drama was written by Lucille Fletcher. The original score was by Bernard Herrmann. This is the Columbia Broadcasting System.
Wow, how ironic to have a wartime commentary that was included in that broadcast at the end of a show about the Grim Reaper, huh? Wow. So, anyway, I hope you enjoyed that. Of course, as always, Orson Welles is most excellent in all of his roles. And as stated, that role was actually written for him originally. You know, more recently, the television series Supernatural, I think it is still running. It started in 2005, portrayed all four of the biblical horsemen of the apocalypse, no less. Death was, raven-haired, pale, and gaunt. Riching's performance in that show is pretty much the modern standard of how death would be portrayed. Doesn't always have to be male, though. W. Somerset Maugham depicted death as a woman in his very famous one-paragraph story, Appointment in Samarra. In that tale, a merchant servant flees from Baghdad because he sees death in the marketplace there. While the servant runs off to Samarra, the merchant confronts Death, who reveals that she was shocked to see him in Baghdad because she was meeting him later in Samarra. The moral of that story? One can't cheat death. There was also a really good show that the song I played at the beginning of this episode of Savage Science Radio came from, Dead Like Me. It was a really short little show, 2003 to 2004. It featured a number of reapers, many of whom were female. George Lass, which was played by Ellen Muth, was the star of the show. Of course, there was Laura Harris and Jasmine Guy also in there. And Mandy Patinkin, which a lot of people remember from Alien Nation, was in that series as well. Of course, that series met its own Grim Reaper after just two seasons. They tried to have a movie, I think, but I don't think it did all that well. But anyway, it was an interesting concept. And going on to the science part of death, actually, there's a lot of people who wonder, is there life after death? Can science actually explain it? Well, in 1991, in Atlanta, Georgia, resident Pam Reynolds had a near-death experience, also known as an NDE. Reynolds underwent surgery for a brain aneurysm, and the procedure required the doctors to drain all the blood from her brain. Reynolds was kept literally brain dead by the surgical team for a full 45 minutes. Despite being clinically dead, when Reynolds was resuscitated, she described some amazing things. She recounted experiences she had while she was dead, like interacting with deceased relatives. Even more amazing is that Reynolds was able to describe aspects of the surgical procedure down to the bone saw that we used to remove part of her skull. Now, what's remarkable, although not unique, about Reynolds' experience is that the combination of an NDE and an out-of-body experience, or OBE, was combined. Science has made its headway toward explaining these weird phenomena. Two studies on the separate aspects of Reynolds' experience were conducted in 2007. Each seems to explain how a person can have an OBE or an NDE, but do they hold up in explaining experiences like Reynolds? Well, as many as 18% of people brought back from death after a heart attack said that they had had an NDE. And that was actually reported, I think, in Time magazine in an article. Now, while religious adherents might not be surprised by these accounts, the idea that human consciousness and the body exist distinctly from each other flies in the face of science, of course. A brain-dead person should not be able to form new memories. He shouldn't have any consciousness at all, really. So how can anything but a metaphysical explanation cover NDEs? Now, a study from the University of Kentucky has quickly gained ground among scientists as possibly the best explanation for NDEs. Researchers there theorize that the mysterious phenomenon is really an instance of the sleep disorder rapid eye movement, or REM, intrusion. Now, in this disorder, a person's mind can wake up before his body, and hallucinations and the feeling of being physically detached from his body can occur. The Kentucky researchers believe that NDEs are actually REM intrusions triggered in the brain by traumatic events like cardiac arrest. If this is true, then this means the experiences of some people following near death are confusion from suddenly and unexpectedly entering a dreamlike state. This theory helps explain what has always been a tantalizing aspect of the mystery of NDEs, how people can experience sights and sounds after confirmed brain death. The area where REM intrusion is triggered is found in the brain stem, the region that controls the most basic functions of the body, and it can operate virtually independent from the higher brain. So even after the higher regions of the brain are dead, the brain stem can conceivably continue to function, and REM intrusion could still occur. Okay, now this sounds like a good explanation for NDEs, but what about OBEs, the out-of-body experiences? Are they the same thing? Well, let's, you know, tackle that. while the REM intrusion theory for near-death experiences explains the apparent hallucinations that accompany NDEs, another aspect remains a mystery. Now, how can a person watch his body after he dies? Though out-of-body experiences are sometimes reported as part of the near-death experience, they can also stand alone, indicating that they are a different animal than NDEs. This is supported by a bit of accidental research. To find the cause of a 43-year-old epileptic patient's seizures, Swiss neurologist Dr. Olaf Blanc conducted a brain mapping test using electrodes planted on the brain to determine which area controls what function. As one region was being stimulated, the woman had a sudden out-of-body experience. She told Blanc that she could see herself from above. Now, Blanc determined that by electrically stimulating the woman's angular gyrus, which is part of the temporoparietal junction, he could induce her OBEs. What's remarkable is that the patient experienced an OBE each time her angular gyrus was arbitrarily stimulated. At any given time, the brain is assaulted with all kinds of information, and as a result, we become desensitized to the sights and sounds around us, such as the buzz of a fluorescent light, for example. Now, the temporoparietal junction, TBJ, is responsible for sorting through this disparate information and putting it together into a coherent package. The TPJ also happens to be the region that controls our comprehension of our own body and its situation in space. Blanc believes that a misfiring of this region is responsible for OBEs. If any of the information being sorted by the temporal parietal junction becomes crossed, like where we are in space, then we could seemingly be released from the confines of our body, if even just for a moment. Now, both Blanc's and the University of Kentucky's theories explain OBEs and NDEs, but what about when you put the two together as an explanation for experiences like that of Pam Reynolds? This still does not resolve how Pam Reynolds and others like her view themselves outside of their bodies while they are brain dead. NDEs may be a result of REM intrusion triggered by the brain stem, but OBEs are controlled by a region of the higher brain which is clinically dead when NDEs occur. What's more, it seems logical to believe that the higher brain must still function in order to interpret the sensations produced by the REM intrusion triggered in the brain stem. Even though combining the University of Kentucky and Blanc theories does not produce an explanation for NDEs, it does not mean that either theory is wrong, okay? Research in one area often leads to a breakthrough in another. Perhaps we'll find that out in an organic function that is indeed behind the NDEs. If neurology does come up with a definitive explanation for NDEs, then the mystery will still remain, of course. Science could explain the how, and while leaving the why unanswered, which, you know, happens often, which is part of the controversy, discovering an explanation for NDEs may reveal a door to the metaphysical world, which could possibly be unlocked and explored by science, which is something a lot of people are trying to do all the time. As physician Dr. Melvin Morse wrote, quote, "Simply because religious experiences are brain-based does not automatically lessen or demean their spiritual significance. Indeed, the findings of neurological substrates to religious experience can be argued to provide evidence for their objective reality." Very interesting point of view right there. It should be also pointed out that just because there's not an actual explanation doesn't necessarily confirm the fact that it was indeed a religious or spiritual or metaphysical cause as well. So until there's a little bit more research and a little bit more answers, I think that we will say the jury's out on that one. Of course, the two camps will always be arguing about it, even if there is proof. So, you know, that's typical of human behavior. Now, if you wanted to know more about some of these near-death experiences, there's actually a website called Near-Death Experiences and the Afterlife. And it literally has all these people that are supposed to, they call themselves experts. There's notable cases that are on there. There's resources in multimedia, all sorts of research conclusions. Well, you know, their conclusions. Anyways, it's www.near-death.com. You can look that up. It's got some interesting things and some people I didn't expect to see their names on there, too. I think that they're really looking for some scientific connection with it. Now, they also have, if you want to read more about the woman that we were talking about, Pam Reynolds, Light and Death by the founder of the Atlanta Study, Dr. Michael Sabom, about the case of Pam Reynolds, you can find, and 50 other cases in that particular publication. And The Spiritual Brain by Mario Beauregard and Denise O'Leary mentions Pam Reynolds' case and other evidence for quote-unquote spiritual experience outside the body, so that's another take on that. Of course, you can also look up the actual study to see about the neurological components. Now, the other side of it, which, you know, they had the near death, and of course the other one was the OBE that had occurred. There's a website called Out of Body Experience Research Foundation, which I guess would be OBERF. And it basically does the same thing as the other. It talks about quote-unquote spiritually transformative events, consciousness studies, has extensive information and research. They encourage people to share their stories and learn more about different states of consciousness. And that is at www.oberf.org. And it's kind of an interesting little site. I climbed through it. And if you wanted to read a little bit more scientific articles regarding this, there is a Journal of Society of the Society for Psychical Research 2001 by Adrian Parker called What Can Cognitive Psychology and Parapsychology Tell Us About Near-Death Experiences? I thought that was interesting, and that was published in 2001. And that Dr. Melvin Morse, who's a medical doctor, he wrote an article called The Right Temporal Lobe and Associated Limbic Lobe Structures as the Biological Interface with an Interconnected Universe. And you can find that at www.melvinmorse.com. As far as the rest of it's concerned, you're kind of on your own with your Google. It is a fascinating topic. And next week, join us for a really scary episode. No, just joking. Well, it is scary to some people. It's going to be about ghosts. So hold on to your hat and turn your lights on, or turn them off if you want to get a little bit of a fright. So anyway, that's about it for Savage Science Radio this week. I'd like to thank Nick Palucco for the beautiful show graphics, and Dennis Bond and Hawk Productions for that fantastic intro we use every week. And I'd like to thank Google for knowing what I was going to search for before I searched for it. It's like it's in my head or something. I don't know what's going on. Their analytics are working very well these days, let me tell you. Anyway, join us next week for your spooky show, and I hope you have a wonderful week. Until then, keep your powder and your pants dry, and happy trails to you.
Jesus. Last night I said